This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to five women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229, or visit preborn.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thanks so much for joining us again. Everything changes in our lives the moment our first baby is born, not just for mom, but also for dad. The love and sense of responsibility that you have for your child is just beginning. But how can dads in particular fully embrace their roles as what my next guest calls hero dads? So joining us now is Dr. Meg Meeker. She is a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics and an associate professor of medicine at Michigan State School of Human Medicine. She's a leading authority on parenting and works with the NFL Fatherhood Initiative. And we're going to talk about her book, You've Got This, Unlocking the Hero Dad Within. And Meg, it's great to have you with us. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me, Janet.
Thank you for being here. How would you describe the hero dad? If you're using that term, who are you talking about in particular?
You know, I thank you for the question. I'm talking about every dad out there who has a child, and this sort of stuns a lot of fathers. But here's why I say every dad is a hero to his child. You know, when children are born 6 months, 9 months, a year of age, they look up to their dad needing affection, attention, admiration, and many things. And so they see this man as larger than life. They hang on his words. He's sort of the center of their world. He is the one who protects them and keeps them safe. But here's the issue. Fathers don't see that in themselves. So what I encourage dads to do is take yourself back to that 4, 5, 8-year-old child and remember what you wanted from your father. Maybe you got it, maybe you didn't. Maybe you didn't have a dad. But that desire to have those good things from your dad, or the hole you felt in your heart because you didn't get them, helps men realize how enormous they are in their children's eyes. And in my experience, most men don't see themselves as hero. They say, I'm not an NFL player. I'm not in the NBA. But to a child, that's not what a hero is. And I believe God creates inside of every man the ability or makes them a hero to their child right from the get-go. And that's what dads need to get.
Yes, absolutely. That's very true. I don't think a lot of dads do naturally see themselves as heroes. And isn't that maybe because mom seems to dominate everything? Mom is the one who had the baby. Mom is the one who feeds the baby. Mom is the one who may be home all day with the baby. Do you think that that contributes to the way dads see themselves as important in their own children's lives, that mom has more of it than I need to have?
Oh, absolutely. Think about what we're told as women. From the time we're pregnant, we need to eat the right things. We need to take the right vitamins because we're in charge, we believe, of the health of our baby.
Right.
And then when baby is born, we feel a lot of pressure to nurse the baby. We are the sole supplier of nutrition and life to this child. And a lot of women feel a lot of pressure to be the sole provider of food and sustenance to the child. And while we say, oh, isn't that a great thing, what happens is dads immediately feel pushed aside. And I'm a pediatrician who says, look, baby needs to attach and bond to dad as well. That means, and La Leche League would get very angry at me, that means that dad needs to feed the babies, and it's perfectly good to put some breast milk into a bottle, A, to help mom get some rest and sleep, and B, to help dad attach and bond because babies need that. So really right from the first year of life, the message to the family is mom's the center. It's too much pressure for moms. It's not the way God designed things, and it's not healthy for the dad-child relationship. in the long run.
Yeah, that's true. And you say in the book that to kids, it is dad who is the center of the family. What do you mean by that? Because moms might get their dander up and say, wait a minute, what about me over here?
You can't imagine the hate mail I get from mothers because I encourage fathers. And I said, it's not an either or situation.
No.
But here's the thing. We all know, because we're all a son or a daughter, that what we wanted from our dad was very different from what we wanted from our mom. What we expected from our mom is different from what we expect from our dads. For instance, kids in the early years of life and throughout life believe that mom has to love them.
Yes.
You know, mom can't go anywhere. That's why kids can be so mean to their mothers. Hmm. Because they believe that mom's love is non-negotiable, because primarily we believe that if we aren't even worthy of mom's love, we might as well hang it up.
Right.
Because if nobody else in the world loves you except your mom, then you're kind of okay. But if mom doesn't even love you, then there's nowhere to go. But in a child's eyes, and this isn't something we teach kids, I think it's intuitive. A dad's love is negotiable. You know, dad can choose to love you or choose not to love you. There is an authority we see in a father, and I think it's intuitive. So if dad shows you affection and love in those early years and throughout your life, the way you perceive yourself is different from when mom shows you love. If dad gives you a nod of approval, you feel like you can do anything. If dad shows you love, you think, wow, I must be really something. If dad wants to take me on errands on Saturday, wow, dad loves to be with me. I must be something. Now, mom can say, let's go to the grocery store, and you go, ah, yeah, okay. So from a child's perspective, you know, the love and affection you receive from your dad feels very different and feels bigger, not better, than when you receive a mom's love.
That's so interesting. Would you say the reverse is true, that when a father is not present in your life, or a father is abusive, or a father is uninvolved in a child's life, that that has a bigger impact on the child, were the mother to do the same?
Well, that's hard to tell, but I'll tell you it has an enormous impact. And this is why I know that, because we have many more single moms out there and dads who are gone than mothers who are gone.
Yes.
So we have more single moms than single dads. So it's we can measure the impact of fatherlessness easily and quickly on children, because it's a more common situation.
Yes.
And we know that when a child doesn't have a father, studies show, the child's more likely to have depression, anxiety, a lower sense of self-esteem, more likely to do more poorly in school, less likely to graduate from high school and go on to college, more likely to get involved in high-risk behaviors like sex, drugs, and alcohol. And when you look at the research on mothers compared to fathers, it's about 7 to 1.
Wow.
So clearly we've put a lot more emphasis on what goes into the mother-child relationship than the father-child relationship. But we know the devastating effects of a child if he doesn't have his dad around.
Very true. And having a dad around, I know you referenced your own dad in the book, and it really touched me when I read that dad was your safety net. And I thought, man, I relate to that. I know exactly what you're talking about. There is a relationship with your dad that is really unique, isn't there, when you have a good dad who really gave you a good upbringing?
Oh, you know, and unquestionably, and I will say I was closer to my mother. We talked about everything. I loved being with my mother. And my dad was an introvert, and he was a very quiet man, very cerebral, very smart man. But I always knew when my dad had my back, it meant something. Then when my mother had my back, I expected my mother to be the fan of everything I did. And maybe my dad was, but I looked at my dad as the guy who is going to make everything okay, the guy who is going to protect me, the guy who drove me crazy and said, you can't date that guy, I really don't like him. You know, the guy who sort of was the heavy. But, you know, deep down, we wear that sense of protection from our fathers as a badge of honor. While we hate it during the teen years, the reality is, and women don't want to admit this, it's so anti-PC, and it feels very anti-woman, but hear me, because I think everybody understands what I'm saying. Girls need protection and want protection from their dads, because we know we're smaller than most men. We don't have androgen in our system. We don't have those kinds of muscles. So when we get it from our dads, it makes us feel good and safe.
Hang on a second. Great point. We'll come back with Dr. Meg Meeker. You've got this, Unlocking the Hero Dad Within. Back in a moment.
"80% of the time, an abortion-minded mother who views an ultrasound or sonogram of her baby will choose life. Here's the story of Candace.
The sonogram sealed the deal for me. My baby was like this tiny little spectrum of hope. And I saw his heart beating on the screen. And knowing that there's life growing inside, I mean, that sonogram changed my life. I went from just Candace to mom. Thank you to everybody that has given these gifts. You guys are giving more than money. You guys are giving love."
There are currently preborn centers which do not have an ultrasound machine. Would you sponsor a machine today? Dial #250 and say keyword baby. That's #250 and say baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com. Your love can save a life.
Many people in developing nations have no access to desperately needed medical care. That's why Mercy Ships brings volunteers aboard our hospital ship, the Africa Mercy, to give the world's forgotten poor the free medical care they need. We have an immediate need for registered nurses, especially with a pediatric specialty. As a volunteer nurse, you won't just give life-altering health care, you'll receive so much in return.
It's an amazingly rewarding experience.
You'll give hope and make a difference in the lives of those who have virtually no access to medical aid.
It's such a fantastic thing to do. Everybody who I've met on this ship either wants to come back and do it again, or they're already here for the second, third, or tenth time.
So what are you waiting for? Show mercy to someone today.
I would say go for it.
Get more information and learn how to apply by visiting mercyships.org/nurses. That's mercyships.org/nurses.
To Janet Mefford today. It's great to have you here and great to have with us Dr. Meg Meeker. She's out with a new book, You've Got This, Unlocking the Hero Dad Within. And I agree with you, Meg, what you said right before we went to the break. It's a little un-PC to say so, but it's absolutely true that girls need and girls want protection from their fathers. That's such a basic thing, isn't it?
It is a basic thing, but we've sort of normalized crazy, Janet, and I think everybody knows that we don't always say it.
Yes.
And the idea that a 16-year-old girl who's dating a 17 or 18-year-old boy is on equal terrain is wrong. You put a 130-pound 16-year-old girl in a car driven by an 18-year-old boy who's 200 pounds, she's out of her league.
Yeah.
And a girl will look up, if you will, in quotes, to that guy no matter what. He's bigger, he's stronger. And the truth of the matter is he can overtake her whenever he feels like that. We as women live with that underlying fear all the time.
Yep.
But we don't want to admit it. If I'm in a dark alley alone, I'm much more likely to come out scathed than if I'm in a dark alley with my 210-pound husband.
Yes.
That's the reality.
Yes.
And so women want that. They like it. But we don't want to say that. But we need to say that because we're talking about our children.
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I've had conversations to that effect before about with men I know. And I'd say, if it was midnight and you lived in the city and it was dark, would you walk down a block to get a gallon of milk if you needed it? And he says, sure. All the guys, yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I say, no woman in her right mind would ever do that.
No woman would do this. And I read an article recently that really got my ire up, and it was this, that chivalry in men should go away and it should be dead. And what a horrible statement.
It is.
A, chivalry in men, I believe, is a God wired that into men. I think that's something that we need to encourage, not just for men, but for women as well.
Yes, I agree with you. So when you're talking to dads who may have had bad dads themselves or absent fathers, and they say, I don't think I can be a hero dad, I have no example that I can look back to imitate, how do you encourage that new father? Yes, you can. You can do just fine.
Great question. And I do a lot of work with the NFL because they have a fatherhood initiative. And the reason I do that, because I thought, what an odd thing to ask a middle-aged grandmother to come and talk to these men who are such elite athletes. This doesn't make sense. And they said, yes, it does. A, because they will listen to their mothers, because that's who they relate to, and you're about their mother's age. Mm-hmm. I said, thank you very much.
Yep.
And also because you understand what kids need and where kids are coming from. And here are the struggles that I see in a lot of men who grew up without fathers. First of all, they don't have a lot of self-confidence because they feel that if they were worth something, dad would have stuck around. As a child, they can't perceive that maybe dad has his own issues, alcoholism, problems, whatever. Maybe that their father never grew up with a dad, and they really don't know how to do this dad thing. So it really had nothing to do with them, but as a child, you can't wrap your head around that. Second, they literally have no model to emulate. They don't know how to talk. They don't know how to behave. They don't know what to say. They don't know what to do. And when I say that, I mean that literally. I've had men ask me, I'm going to be with my daughter on a Saturday morning. She's 10. What should I do with her? What do I say? And so many men come into this parenting thing with what I call a preload, their own experience. If they were never talked to by a father, they don't know how to talk to a child. If they were yelled at by a father, that's their default. That's all they know. We as adults repeat what we know, not what we want. So we repeat with our children our childhood experience. So if we had a lack of knowledge about what a father was, we go into parenting with an empty slate. We literally don't have a roadmap. But here's the cool thing about dads, and this is what I say to young dads who go, I can't do this. I'm not a hero dad. I said, yes, you can. If you're a football player, if you're a professional, if you're good at anything, you have a skill set. Let's transfer that skill set onto your parenting. And this light bulb goes off. Are you a disciplined person? Yes. Then you can be disciplined in your parenting. Are you a team player? Yes. Can you achieve goals? Yes. So let's give you some very clear, specific goals for your parenting. And dads go, I can do that. They're much more pragmatic. And then I say, it's also very important to look at your preload. What was your experience as a child with your father? When you recognize what your starting point is, I'm starting off my parenting experience knowing that as a child, what I know of a parent is they're never around. They always yell at me. They paid no attention, whatever it is. To recognize that unless you change that pattern, that will become your default. So if you want to change that pattern, you need to recognize what came before to carve out a new path. And men get that, and it feels very encouraging to them. And I say, no matter where you came from, you can be a great dad to your kids. I know this because God the Father created you to be that child's dad. Yep. Nobody else but your child's dad.
That's wonderful to give men some hope who might feel they're complete failures before they ever begin. And, you know, they have a built-in beginning because they love their children. I mean, that starts.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, do you love the child? That's where you start. And you are the father and that's your daughter or that's your son. One of the things you mentioned in the book, Meg, which I think is so important, and I know this comes up a lot when I used to read all these new mother books and, you know, when my kids were little. One of the things that fathers have in their bag of tricks that mom doesn't have usually to the same extent is the ability to play. You know, dad's the one who's tossing the toddler in the air and mom's saying, stop, she's going to die. Yeah. That sort of thing. But what about the importance of dad playing with his kids and roughhousing?
You know, and it's one of the things that drives mothers crazy because they'll let a son climb to the first branch of a tree and dad'll let him climb to the top of the tree,
yep.
And then they'll have a big argument about it. And mom will say something like, if you really cared, or if you were a better dad, you would never let a child. Well, it's really important. And we have studies to show this too, Janet. That's the interesting thing. And, you know, my husband and I raised four kids who are adults now. We have five grandkids. So I really get this because as a pediatrician, I know everything that can go wrong with a child.
Yes.
You know, I've seen them from the car accidents. I've seen them falling out of the trees. I've seen, you know, what happens. But dads are more prone to allowing their child to take risks, to fall down, to fail, and say, guess what, you can get back up. Yeah, you broke your arm, but you're going to be okay. What did you learn? Yeah, you made a big mistake, and you didn't turn in your homework, so what have you learned? Mothers will rush in and protect the child from failure.
Yeah.
And that's a terrible thing to do.
It's true.
Because it's really people who are very successful in all areas of their lives, relationships, professions, athletes, you know, musicians, are the people who've been knocked around, who've tripped on themselves over and over and over, who failed and gotten back up again. And so, you know, Winston Churchill said, never, never, never quit. You know, and it's the learning how not to quit because you've taken a risk and you've failed that really allows you to achieve and succeed. That's where fathers really shine. And mothers tend to come in and really, in many ways, this is why I think we have a lot of 20-somethings, particularly men, who don't want to leave home. Because mom always said, I will take care of it for you. I will reduce your risk to almost nothing. It's okay. I've got this. And we don't allow our sons to mature and grow up because part of that experience is falling and failing and taking risks.
That's so true. That is so true. That's such an important point. And you talk quite a bit about all the different things that you can do to live like a hero dad and acting like the grown-up and be a leader, not a coach. So many good things, so many good tips people can read when they pick up a copy of your book. But if you had to reduce it to one thing, if you could reduce it to one thing, what would you say is the most important thing that you ought to do to begin to be a hero dad?
Great. Show up for your kids. Literally. Come in the house, turn your phone off, look them in the eye, say, let's go outside and do something. Let's read a book. Let me help you with your homework. If fathers were fully present for their kids for 15 minutes more per day for a month, they'd have a new child on their hands. So really show up. The second is model great character. Christians follow Jesus by studying his character. Yes, we want a relationship, and we need a relationship. And yes, we want Christ to work through us. But let's be honest. We learn humility by seeing what it looks like, by paying attention to how Christ talked to people. I talk in the book, there's a whole chapter called God Shares a Name with You Dads, and that's Father. So if you really want to know what a father looks like, study God and be that to your children. Model humility, model courage, model tenacity, model perseverance, model integrity. Tell the truth in front of your kids. If you want your child to have great character, show that character and model it in your home, and you're there. Talk less and be more and be present for your kids. If dads only did those two things, that's enough.
Yeah.
That's enough.
That's great. That's great. Let him climb the tree now and then, it would seem.
Yes. Let him climb to the top.
I love that. Yeah. I love that. Moms, you got to let that happen. It's important. Well, great book. You've got this, Unlocking the Hero Dad Within. Great to have Dr. Meg Meeker with us. Thank you so much, Meg. It was a lot of fun to have you.
Thank you, Janet.
All right. God bless. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today right after this. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to 5 women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229 or visit preborn.com. We're back on Janet Mefford Today. I think this is such a great thing that we now have in production this Roe v. Wade movie. Have you heard about this? And things thus far have not gone so well in terms of, well, let's just say the backlash a little bit. Nick Loeb is the director for this film, and you might recall his name. I'd never heard of him before. He had this court battle with his ex-girlfriend, Sofia Vergara, over their frozen embryos. You might remember that. But at any rate, he is co-directing this pro-life story of Roe v. Wade. Stacey Dash is to star in this movie. And they've been working really hard on this, shooting in New Orleans. And it's interesting how many people are giving them a hard time about this. This is from The Hollywood Reporter. Nick Loeb was walking to his car with a production assistant during a day of shooting Roe v. Wade outside Tulane University. And a woman wearing a headset came up and said, "Are you the director?" And Nick Loeb said, when he told her that he was the director, she said something very mean to him. And then she threw her headset on the ground and walked off. And then he later found out she was the electrician on the movie. Anecdotes such as this have become fairly common since Loeb and his production partner, Kathy Allen, began shooting their pro-life feature film in and around New Orleans. While Loeb has been in the news in recent years because of his pro-life battle with his ex-girlfriend, there's been little information about this movie. Well, of course, there's little information about this movie because of how much backlash there would be. The radio silence until now has been by design for the security of the cast and the crew and in order to obtain shooting locations. And they get into a little bit of detail on this. The film has been under such tight wraps that even the major cast members had not been revealed until just recently. But it's been a challenging shoot. At Louisiana State University, Loeb says, "We were told we were rejected due to our content, even though it will be a PG-rated film. They refused to put it in writing, but they told us on the phone it was due to content." And at Tulane, where Loeb is an alum, the film shot one day, but after the school newspaper reported on the nature of the project, producers were denied a second day of shooting, according to Loeb. The universities say, oh, no, it was logistics. Sure. OK. Then there was a synagogue in New Orleans that producers rented for catering and as a place for extras to hang out. Once they found out what the film was about, Loeb says, they locked us out. We had to call the police so that the extras and caterers could retrieve their possessions. And actors have walked away once they realized there was a pro-life tilt to the film. They were, I guess, 3 local actors who are part of it who got out. Now, this is kind of funny. One of the local actors was to play Norma McCorvey, who, you know, is the central figure, Roe, of Roe v. Wade. She begged for the role and then apparently walked out when she realized who Norma McCorvey was. So this is so important, though. We have so many people on the left yelling and screaming about the potential of the next Supreme Court justice maybe being the deciding vote in overturning Roe v. Wade if a case that would potentially overturn it ever came before the justices. They're going nuts over this whole thing. But Nick Loeb was on recently with Tucker Carlson talking a little bit about some of the trouble he's run into beyond what I just told you. This is Cut 3.
I've already run into some problems. So, you know, we had a lot of difficulty raising the money in Hollywood, so yeah. We decided to do a crowdfunder. We created a crowdfund site called RoeVWadeMovie.com, and we launched on Facebook to try to raise money, and even Facebook tried to shut us down. And, you know, we talk about essentially the story of the film, of what happens and how the media was manipulated by some of the characters like Dr. Bernard Nathanson and Larry Lader and Betty Friedan, and how they were lied to about back alley abortions, and about how many women were dying, and they made up fake numbers for the media to have fake news back then to push their agenda. And a lot of the truth that we talk about in the film, a lot of people don't want that truth to come out.
Well, of course they don't want it to come out, because if you expose the abortion industry and the Roe v. Wade decision and everything that's gone into pushing this lie on the American people for all of these years, a lot of people who make money off abortion are going to get upset about it. But in fact, it is horrible. It has been a big lie. A lot of people who are part of the big lie along the way, like Bernard Nathanson, ended up changing their minds. People like Abby Johnson, people like Norma McCorvey, People came to their senses. And the thing that really makes me crazy about this whole thing is you consider that the Democrats have such a lock on, for example, the African-American community. There are a lot of great black pro-lifers, of course, but there need to be a lot more, because when you consider what a racist Margaret Sanger was, a eugenicist, she wanted to wipe out the non-white population and talked all about it. So how is it this isn't widely known? Because there's a media blackout on it. People don't want anybody to know about this. If you had all of these people recognizing how many babies have been slaughtered and how this was the dream of Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, they would be shocked and horrified, as they should be. Meanwhile, we have CNN touting this poll that's come out suggesting that, you know, this is just a wonderful thing. You know, Roe v. Wade is fantastic and most people think so, which is just insane if you think about it. But listen to cut one.
Almost 7 in 10 women, according to a new poll, want Roe versus Wade to stay intact. What do you say to those women who say, what are you going to do here? How are you going to protect this right?
Public opinion polls showed that a majority of Americans, okay? I mean, across party lines, look at this. Should the Supreme Court overturn Roe versus Wade? 67%, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, say no. Only 29% say yes at the moment. So how is it that Congress is so out of step with where Americans are?
Well, that's a fair question.
Right, if you look at the polling, this is a Kaiser poll, Kaiser Family Foundation. 67% of Americans say no, the Supreme Court should not overturn Roe v. Wade. Only 29% say yes.
Roe versus Wade is extremely popular. It polls in the high 60s, and it has for the last 70s, like 15 years.
Yeah.
The American public likes the idea of sticking with this precedent. We've heard
Murkowski doesn't want it overturned. You're right.
Thing.
We have that 68% or 70%
yeah,
of Americans.
It's actually the poll's remarkable. The Kaiser Foundation poll that I think Believe Errol's referring to, 67% of Americans say they do not want Roe to be overturned.
Okay, so that was a montage Newsbusters put together of all of the CNN hosts touting the same poll over and over and over. But as Life News points out, other polling casts serious doubt on whether most of the public actually supports the specifics of Roe. And that's an important distinction. The Barna Group, for example, last year found that almost 70% of Americans would support a heartbeat law, which bans abortion after you can hear the unborn baby's heartbeat. So does that sound like 70% of America just wants abortion on demand all 9 months of pregnancy? You have to get into the details a little bit in order to bring that out. Now, Life News also reported last month about a Gallup poll finding Americans' beliefs about abortion have not changed. More Americans, 48%, still believe abortion is morally wrong, while 43% believe it is morally acceptable. This is just last month, so you already have a 5-point spread on the morality of abortion. These poll numbers have remained consistent over the past several years. Thanks to modern medical advances and the educational work of the pro-life movement, the humanity of the unborn child is clearer than ever to the average American. Pew also conducts a similar poll about the morality of abortion. Its question and findings are slightly different. There was a 2017 poll saying more than 4 in 10 Americans say having an abortion is morally wrong, while 19% think it is morally acceptable, and 34% say it is not a moral issue. I don't know how you'd fall into that last category. The difference is that Pew asks whether having an abortion is morally wrong or morally acceptable, while Gallup asks if an abortion is morally wrong or acceptable. The new Gallup poll from last month asked Americans about the morality of many different issues, things like marijuana and fornication and all the other things. Two other questions of interest to pro-lifers involved assisted suicide and human cloning. Euthanasia advocates have been pushing to legalize assisted suicide, as you know, and according to Gallup, a slim majority of Americans are buying into the false death with dignity claims of the euthanasia movement. And that's one to really keep our eye on, because that's going to become a growing issue, as we know. I just think it's very, very unhelpful, to say the least, to have major media not reporting on these other polls, which, by the way, they don't. And in fact, Life News pointed out that the Barna Group from last year reporting that almost 70% of Americans would support a heartbeat bill, that didn't receive any attention from the dominant media. They just acted like it didn't exist. But, oh, they'll tell you about 67% of Americans supporting Roe. How many of those people really know the details on Roe and really would answer differently if a different question were posed to them? on the matter of human life. We're going to come back. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. Stay with us.
Now, how did people get to the Americas? This is Ken Ham, heading up the ministry that built a full-size Noah's Ark. One of the great mysteries of history is how humans got to the Americas. Many scientists assume they had to go over land, crossing land bridges. That's because they believe ancient man was too primitive to sail to the coast. But now researchers are rethinking this assumption. Many now think the evidence in the Americas suggests some people did sail to the Americas, where they started new settlements. This fits with what we'd expect from the Bible. Noah and his sons were obviously shipbuilders and would have passed this skill on. Now, some of the people who left Babel, well, they used boats as they began to explore the world. And they were the original Christopher Columbuses, who discovered a new world.
Discover more about human migrations, Babel, and the true history of humanity at AnswersRadio.com. And listen to this program again or share it with others at AnswersRadio.com.
When I first found out I was pregnant, I was surrounded by fear and disbelief. My boyfriend told me at the time to get an abortion. There was no negotiating.
This is the story of a young lady who decided to keep her baby after hearing her baby's beautiful heartbeat on ultrasound. The Ministry of Preborn provides ultrasounds for pregnancy centers across America for free. When an abortion-minded woman hears her baby's heartbeat on ultrasound, she is 80% more likely to keep her baby. And the story doesn't end there.
My son Rent turned 5 months this week, and even though there are still uncertainties in my life, the one thing I know is I get to watch him grow.
Your gift of $140 will cover the cost of 5 ultrasounds. All donations are tax deductible. You can help save a baby's life right here in America by donating to Preborn. To donate, dial pound 250, keyword baby, pound 250, baby, or donate securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Janet Mefford Today. Well, we were all delighted to see the U.S. Supreme Court go the right way in the NIFLA v. Becerra case. In that decision, the justices rightly stated that the state of California could not force pro-life pregnancy centers to promote abortion. Now, here's an interesting question. Could that decision also affect the issue of reparative therapy, which the state of California wants to ban across the board? Could this pro-life decision positively affect the free speech of both therapists and of their patients who seek help breaking free from homosexuality? Well, we're going to examine this today with Peter Sprigg, who's written about this. He is Senior Fellow for Policy Studies at the Family Research Council. Peter, great to welcome you back. How are you?
Thank you, Janet. I'm well.
Very good. I think this is really interesting because one of the things that was tackled, I know, in this NIFLA case before the Supreme Court, one aspect of it was free speech, but there was another aspect of it in which the court had rejected this idea of professional speech. How do you think these cases might coincide with one another, the issue at least of pro-life pregnancy centers being forced to, you know, make certain speech under the threat of the government and under state law versus the state of California now wanting to enact AB 2943?
Yes. Well, as you mentioned, free speech and the implications of the First Amendment guarantees of freedom of speech were a key issue in the NIFLA case involving the rights of pregnancy resource centers. But it was interesting in Justice Thomas's majority opinion, he cited negatively the case that had upheld California's earlier ban on sexual orientation change efforts with minors by licensed mental health providers. Now, the bill they're considering now is even more draconian because it would apply to adults as well as minors and to people who are not mental health, not licensed mental health providers as well. But the earlier bill was challenged in court and was upheld by the Ninth Circuit in part because of this argument that, oh, it's okay, it's not a free speech violation because the state has more leeway in regulating what they call professional speech. Well, Justice Thomas said He acknowledged that there's a division among the circuit courts across the country, but said the Supreme Court has never recognized professional speech as a separate category that is not worthy of First Amendment protection. And he specifically cited the pickup case as something representing this viewpoint that he was rejecting. So we see that as very encouraging, kind of almost an unexpected thing. I mean, I wasn't expecting a reference to, the therapy ban cases in a case about pregnancy centers, and yet it was there in the decision, and strongly suggests that the basis of the Ninth Circuit decision on the therapy ban is really not supported by the Supreme Court.
See, that is so interesting to me because David Pickup, as you and I know, has fought very, very hard on this issue of reparative therapy bans, obviously being a reparative therapist himself. What, though, is going on with that case? Could they actually appeal that decision in the Ninth Circuit to the Supreme Court, or is that currently going on? What do you know about that?
Well, I believe I haven't tracked it real closely, but I do believe I heard that Liberty Counsel, which had represented David Pickup in that case originally, is asking for the case to be reopened and reconsidered in light of this decision from the Supreme Court. Now, I don't know, that may be unusual. I'm not sure. I'm not actually a lawyer myself, for them to actually reopen a case that they've already litigated. Certainly, if California passes this new therapy ban, which is even more draconian, I would expect an immediate legal challenge to it. And partly, I would expect that to rest upon this decision from the Supreme Court.
Yes. Well, it could be the case that somebody else might file a case, and that could end up before the
right.
Supreme Court. Because, I mean, clearly they have. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, as far as I know, there are, I think, perhaps 14 states now. I've seen a list as high as 14 states that have adopted these therapy bans so far. As far as I know, the bills or the laws in California and New Jersey were actually challenged in court and litigated all the way up to the federal circuit court level. So it's also perhaps possible that there could be a new challenge, a completely original challenge begun in one of these other states that has a similar law.
Yes. Now, do you see any significant differences between the NIFLA decision and any case that might come up regarding the reparative therapy potential ban in California that would not make it the same? Or do you think it's similar enough that it warrants another hearing before the Supreme Court on the issue of reparative therapy?
Well, the one difference conceptually in terms of how we view this in the light of the First Amendment and so forth is that the NIFLA case, the pregnancy center case, involved what's referred to as compelled speech. Normally, when we talk about freedom of speech, we think of it in terms of a prohibition on speech. In other words, the government punishing you for saying something that the government doesn't want you to say. Obviously, the First Amendment would not allow the government to do that. But that concept has also been interpreted in a way to say that the government may not compel speech. The government may not force you to communicate a message that you do not want to communicate. And that was what was at issue in the pregnancy center case. California had actually passed a law requiring specific notices with specific wording dictated by the government to be posted in their clinics. And in the case of licensed pregnancy clinics, they had to actually advertise where people could go to get abortions. So that was a compelled speech case. In the case of the therapy, we're talking about more of a traditional prohibition of speech where the law simply prohibits free speech by the therapist if it has as its goal helping someone to change their sexual orientation.
Yes.
So I'm not sure. In a sense, that should make the. I would think would make the therapy the case for the therapy the case in challenging the therapy ban even stronger, because the prohibition of speech by the government is sort of the classic and original concept of free speech that we're talking, that we think of in terms of the First Amendment. But I'm not sure. You get into a lot of details in terms of the precedents and how they're interpreted and so forth. So I'm not 100% sure how the courts would view it. But certainly, I think this recent precedent and the statements by Justice Thomas would give a strong indication.
Well, that's interesting. What I also think comes to mind as I'm thinking through all of this is the recent case with Jack Phillips, where basically it hinged on the fact that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission was showing religious hostility toward him in making opposite decisions for bakeries that did not want to create a biblical message for people who wanted to get cakes with biblical messages. I wonder how much that might matter here. And the reason I say that is when we had David Pickup and Ann Polk from Restored Hope Network and others who were testifying in Sacramento against AB 2943, they didn't have on the other side of the fence actual proof that anybody currently is committing fraud in reparative therapy. And they didn't have anybody, so far as those people testified, and I talked to them about that, where you had people saying, I was harmed by a reparative therapist, and then came forward with an actual name. So, so that seems to be a problem. And at the end of the whole session, they allowed mostly the other side to testify. And David Pickup ended up standing up at the end of the session. You might have seen this. And he said, we can refute everything you guys have just said. Can we have the opportunity to refute it? And they were just shut down. I wonder if that hostility or animus angle might come up if this continues to be litigated and if AB 2943 goes through and it ends up in the courts. What do you think about that?
Well, it's possible that because one thing that has also been an issue in First Amendment cases has been the idea of viewpoint discrimination. In other words, is the government acting in a neutral way in terms of ideology when it restricts speech in some way, or is it targeting one viewpoint for discrimination? Yeah. And that would kind of bring in the masterpiece case that you mentioned. And I think certainly you could make a strong case here that certainly it's the viewpoint that is resistant to the homosexual agenda that's being targeted, and not a contrary viewpoint. That is an issue that would come up. The interesting thing with the NIFLA case is that, I did ask a lawyer this question. I said, why didn't Justice Thomas focus more on the viewpoint discrimination issue? Because Justice Kennedy actually mentioned that in a concurring opinion. And the answer I got was that, well, it is a content-specific, you don't have to reach the question of viewpoint discrimination if you're saying this is targeting the content of the communication, and therefore it violates the First Amendment, regardless of the viewpoint.
Very good. Peter Sprigg with us. Thanks so much, Peter. And thank you for joining us on Janet Mefford today. We'll see you next time.